Welcome to another edition of Geopolitics and Empire. A reminder to support this rebel transmission. You can do that by becoming a paid subscriber on Substack, just $5 a month or $50 a year. And thank you to the people that are joining and supporting the work that I'm doing. We're doing supporter-only Zoom calls every week or two. There's a private chat for supporters. You can also buy me a coffee or send reinforcements via DonorBox. And returning to this transmission, it's a special edition, this time Croatian edition of Geopolitics and Empire. It's my fellow Spanish-speaking Croat, Alex Krainer. He's the author of books like Mastering Uncertainty in Commodities Trading, Grand Deception, and Trend Following Bible, the founder of Krainer Analytics and iSystem Trend Following, a subscription service that helps you navigate trends profitably in multiple financial and commodity markets. And he's got a great Substack at Alex Krainer's Trend Compass. Welcome back to Geopolitics and Empire, Alex.
Great to be with you again, Hervé. It's been a while.
And I wanted to get you back. And we were on a Zoom call the other day when I was a guest on the COVID. Was it the medical ethics group that meets every week? So that was fun. And you know, I still fondly remember our very first discussion. I think it was in 2021, and that was one of my favorite interviews. I think it was a very seminal interview that we can go back to and listen to again, right in the heart of the COVID madness. And so I wanted to get your broad big picture sweep of the world, where you think we are. And maybe given that you specialize in the financial and economic, we can start there. You know, where are we when it comes to the state of the financial system and then the different regions of the world, like USA, Europe, Russia, China, and so forth?
Well, where do we start? It's been slow on the news front recently, hasn't it? So it's almost difficult to pick a point from which to start. But you know, if we start from the financial markets, we have just seen yesterday that inflation is flaring back up. So we're back to 3.5% annualized rate. We had five consecutive months of CPI and core CPI inflations increasing. And we had for the last few weeks, or several months, in fact, that commodity price inflation has been kicking in, and this has not yet been reflected in the CPI inflation. So if we go back to the 1940s inflation and the 1970s inflation, we see the pattern that inflation actually unfolded in three distinct waves. So we had the first wave, then an easing of inflation, then the second wave, and then another easing of inflation almost to the normal levels. And then we had the third wave. And so the current pattern is very closely following in the same trajectory as the 1970s inflation. So this is coming on the horizon, and inflation, you know, as most people intuitively know, but it's an empirical fact, is far and away the greatest destroyer of wealth in real terms. So this is a massive concern, and it's going to impact not only the economy, it's going to impact the politics in the United States and in Western Europe, generally across the Western world. Then we had the yen, which has been for many, 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 many days holding on with its nails to the 150, 152 level to a dollar. And it just looked like it's going to slip past that level. And now, this just happened yesterday. It did. It went to 153, which is, I think, just the beginning. This is, I think, the new 36-year, I think, low for the yen against US dollar. So it's extremely interesting on the financial market. I think we're also entering what many in the financial markets have anticipated for a while, the new commodity super cycle, which means that the commodities, as in terms of other asset values, are going to be increasing very significantly over the next 10 to 25 years. That, you know, we cannot predict that, but these are long secular cycles in the markets. And this is going to change the balance of trade in the world, because for the last several centuries, the Western world has been firmly in control of commodity trade around the world. And I think that for the first time in those several centuries, I would say at the very least 500 years, Western powers are losing control of commodities trade. And so I think that we're looking not only at very acute economic crises that are ahead of us, but also a complete overhaul of the global geopolitical architecture.
Yeah, that would sort of lead me to my next question. You know, I've been following on Telegram Russian economist Sergei Glazyev's statements, which it's fascinating. And I think people need to do this. You need to listen to Russian, Chinese, and not just Western stuff, and you put all the pieces together. And so there's this process of de-dollarization. As you mentioned, gold seems to be more important now as central banks are buying it up. And so what do you see sort of the trend going forward, and what this might look like? Because there are different scenarios, guests that I have on, everyone from I had on Jim Rogers and the Peter Schiffs and the Mark Fabers, and some of them paint these apocalyptic scenarios of the dollar hyperinflating, you know, total collapse. Maybe it doesn't, the scenario is not that extreme, and maybe it's more milder, sort of, you know. So when you hear some of these terms, what do you think? Like de-dollarization, gold, and the status of the dollar?
Well, I think that we will sooner see the collapse of Japanese yen, euro, and possibly British pound before we see the collapse of the dollar. I would expect the dollar to be slowly ground down over many years. Yes, there is de-dollarization in process, but you know, de-dollarization is happening gradually, but dollar is still the standard of exchange. Most people around the world still think in terms of dollars. You know, I'm selling my crop of cocoa, or I'm selling my barrels of oil, and it's always priced in US dollars. People are used to that. It's going to, you know, people's habits take a long time to change. You know, when people in, you know, when the Arabic numerals came to Europe in, I think, 12th century, you know, it was clearly a much superior way for doing math and accounting and science and everything, but it still took several centuries for that to happen. And so I think that's partly to do with people's habits. People are creatures of habit, and I think that we all got used for several generations to denominate everything in dollars. So that in itself is almost like a cultural fact today. So it's going to take a while to unseat the dollar as one of the dominant currencies of exchange around the world. Maybe for that reason, principally. But obviously, the BRICS nations are gearing up for trading between themselves in their own commodities. For a good long while, Sergei Glazyev and the Russians and the Chinese were talking about creating a BRICS currency. But I think that ultimately Glazyev came to the conclusion that this is maybe not worth the trouble, that it's quite sufficient for countries to simply default to their own currencies in their own trades, with the creation of the BRICS bank to mediate. And so I think the dollar is going to be with us for a good long while still, but it's probably going to be losing its purchasing power gradually. Whereas I think that there's a real chance that Japanese yen is going to experience a much more rapid collapse, followed probably by the euro and then by the British pound. And I think all the Western currencies are in trouble. All the Western nations have the problem of debt overhang over their heads. These debts are unpayable. And the only way that their monetary authorities, i.e. the central banks and their treasury departments, can keep their economies somewhat in balance is by, quote-unquote quantitative easing, which is basically printing money out of thin air and spreading it around to their favorite banks and corporations to use them on, you know, useful projects like, control matrix and vaccinations and CBDCs and things like that. Oh, windmills and solar panels and all these wonderful things. So that spending is going to go on, along with inflation. And unfortunately, this spending could be good and justified if it were being spent on useful things. But we increasingly see that it's going spent on things that have to do with these climate mandates. And what's most worrisome is that it's increasingly being spent on the defense the uses and the military industrial complex. And that should send the chills down everybody's spine.
And it does. And I've been tracking that every day, every week, every month now on my former radio program and extrapolating that trend, and you can clearly see it. But before getting to that, the geopolitical and military, you mentioned inflation, and for a long time now I've been saying that is the greatest danger, because we know they've got this project of neo-feudalism, right? The Great Reset, and they want to wipe out the middle class. And it seems like inflation, that's what it's being done through inflation in every country now. Here in Mexico, USA, Europe, just the standard of living is eroding. Wages are not, they don't move. Everything else just shoots right up. And then we end up with a two-class system, the aristocracy and then the plebs and the serfs once again. And you mentioned CBDCs. I listened to Daniela Cambone the other day interviewing a analyst for ITM Trading, an analyst out of Switzerland. I forget his name, Clive maybe, but they were discussing the CBDCs, and maybe one thing that they might do is introduce a new digital currency or CBDC where the debt that you were discussing will remain on the old sort of dollar while everyone starts using the new digital currency, and sort of that's sort of their way of forgetting about the old debt. What are your thoughts when it comes to these globalist agendas and how successful they might be with the CBDC system, the technocracy, the digital IDs? I see every day now, every country is bringing in digital IDs for citizens. And then once you have that digital ID, all public and private services will be carried out through that digital ID. And then, we know how that goes, where if you commit a thought crime, they can just, hit pause on your digital ID and you can't do anything. Your thoughts on some of these technocratic things?
Well, I'm sure they're going to give us an opportunity to re-educate ourselves and to set our thoughts straight, so we're absolved of our sins. But on the serious note, I think that all this is going to fail, and I think that the CBDC as an idea, as a concept, might seem appealing as a form of control of society, because you think that with the help of AI and all these digital IDs and currency that can be programmable so that it only works for you if you're totally compliant with everything that you need to be compliant with, and your social credit score is high enough and blah, blah, blah. All of these things, we can imagine that they might limit how much red meat you might eat a week. You get a 100-gram quota of red meat a week, and then if you want to buy more, then your purchases decline, blah, blah, blah. But, this is all extraordinarily complex, and they are extraordinarily short on talent to build all these things out. So it's not going well. And then not so long ago, I think in 21 or 22, I forget the timeline exactly, but I wrote an article about this on my Substack. I think the title is CBDCs, Why Their Future Is Not So Bright. So they launched a very important CBDC test market in Nigeria in 2021 or 22, I think, maybe even 23, at the end of 22 and 23. I forget exactly. It's not so important, but the important thing is that the project failed in all of 108 or 109 days. And they chose Nigeria very carefully because there are all sorts of complications to CBDC, to introducing CBDCs that have to do with, legacy accounting systems and legal systems and people's debts and salaries and all of these things. I actually once was present in a conference where an Accenture, a person from Accenture, it's no longer called Accenture, that company. It's called something else, I forget. But they made a presentation about introducing CBDC. And one thing I can tell you is that, well, first of all, this man was fully immersed in this problem matter, so he knew a lot. And the second observation is that he wasn't very confident at all. The presentation was more about the problems or and challenges than anything else. And they are really, really multi-layered. So, they carefully chose Nigeria as a test market because there many people are still unbanked. People had simple bank accounts. And so it was practically an ideal test market for them. And they brought, they carefully chose the platform and the architecture for these CBDCs. And they even had a referendum. They asked the people, do you want the CBDC? And something like 95% of the people said, no, we do not want the CBDC. And then the president of the country said, like, well, too bad, because we're going to do it anyway. And then the Central Bank of Nigeria introduced this e-naira instead of the naira currency. And they gave the people something like 2 weeks to convert all of their naira notes and their bank accounts into e-naira. And well, first it didn't go so well, and then they gave them another 10 days or so, and then it still didn't quite work, and most people didn't convert. Some did, most didn't. And then suddenly businesses started failing left and right, because people suddenly had worthless money, money that was no longer legal tender. So, merchants could no longer sell their goods, people could not buy their stuff. And it started to turn into a wholesale rebellion and riots across Nigeria. And it took 108 or 109 days for the whole project to fail. The president lost immediately the next elections. And the governor of the central bank actually ended up in prison for, I don't know if he's still in prison, but he was in prison for many months. This launch was meant to be significant. It was meant to show the success of CBDCs. So they brought, the IMF and they brought a lot of brain power from Western institutions to make sure that this went smoothly. And they completely messed it up. And so now I think it's going to be very difficult for them to find the next nation where, the president or prime minister is going to risk losing the next election, or where the central bank's governor is going to take the risk of ending up in prison if the project doesn't succeed. So the event in Nigeria was very significant. It wasn't advertised, most people never even heard of it. But it's there, and I wrote an article summarizing the whole thing. And so it's not going well, and it's not going well for reasons that I have predicted. And I have certain experience in managing complex software projects. But my projects were not even remotely as complex as what they have to accomplish. And then it has to be, implemented to the whole economy. And, money matters. They have to function smoothly. You can't, like have your bank balance suddenly shift for no discernible reason. People flip out. And, if you do that to millions of people, you have a revolution on your hands. So it's, they talk a good talk. They're making these predictions about how it's going to be. But in actual fact, their arsenal of tools and methods and solutions for implementing the CBDC is even weaker than their, you know, than if you compare to NATO with its military preparedness and their arsenals, it's even weaker. So it's, this thing is not going anywhere. And what I see happening, if they, you know, they will try to push us in the direction of electronic money, which in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing if you have a choice, you know, if they leave you the choice of using the banknotes. But the programmable currencies that are going to be linked to our credit scores and our electronic IDs and all that, that's going nowhere. And what happens in these situations is that people simply opt out. And so you have situations like you have in Argentina or Venezuela, where practically half of the nation's GDP is transacted on the black markets. And the problem with that is that whatever people transact on the black market, and I, you know, like, I don't know this, but friends from Argentina tell me you can buy anything you want on the black market. It's like everything is out there. And once the black market takes root, it's very difficult to do away with it, because it becomes like a magnet, because it's free of red tape. It's a true competitive free market. It attracts both entrepreneurs and merchants, and it attracts people buying. So government simply loses control. And then, you know, they're no longer collecting tax revenue on half of their economy. So for governments, there's a great deal of reasons to hesitate on these projects, you know. So yeah, the globalists in Davos are all gung-ho, but they're ideologues, you know. They don't have a good grasp of how difficult and rife with risk this is. And so they're going to have great difficulty finding willing participants to try, you know, Nigeria 2.0. It's not going anywhere.
And I think the key point that you're making, and I'm seeing this too. So there's some hope, there's some good news here, that just on a technical level, it's difficult for them to carry this stuff out. We can cite a million examples, like even here in Mexico, when the readers for your electricity, we had the old analog ones, and then they brought in the digital smart type of meters. And then for a time in this transition, they were doing the most insane things. Like, they gave me a card once, and they expected me every month to drive somewhere, waste hours of my day. I would have to go to the office of the electric company here in Mexico, scan, wait in line, and pay. And I'm like they were wanting us to do the job for them. And that failed, you know. I was like, I'm not doing this. I'm not, you know, screw this. And it's just a local example of what you're talking about in Nigeria. And so many other ways, you know, they're trying to get Mexicans to use these digital phone payments through the bank here. The first one was called Kodi. Nobody's using it. It failed. They renamed it Dimi now. And on your phone, it says activated. So pay with your phone. Don't pay with cash. And again, no, people aren't using it. So it's just an example of what you're talking about. Yeah. And then, you know, increasing energy issues, blackouts, you know, the electricity isn't stable. And so that goes to what you're saying. You need to have a system that works well for this technocracy to be carried out. Just real quick, just your quick thought on Bitcoin. What is important for you? You wrote a great piece, I remember reading a couple years back, on Bitcoin. Your thoughts there?
Well, you know, I'm agnostic when it comes to Bitcoin. I think it's great technology. I think it has a great promise for, you know, for the future evolution of humanity. I don't know if it's going to be Bitcoin or if it's going to be something else. The problem I have with it at the moment is that, you know, Bitcoin is attracting a lot of attention as an object of speculation. So people are buying and selling Bitcoins because they want to make money. I will get really excited about Bitcoin the day I can walk into a cafe and pay for a round of drinks, or into my grocery store and buy some groceries and pay with Bitcoin. Then I think Bitcoin will begin to fulfill its real potential. Right now, it's just attracting the gambling casino mentality. And so even though the technology is very legit and very useful and very... it's very encouraging that it exists to begin with. It's not yet doing what it's meant to be doing, you know, being an actual legitimate medium of exchange.
And before getting to war, just one more question. My past two podcast interviews dealt with the issue of energy and climate. And, you know, we all know the climate change narrative is false, as they tell us. But I'm still, you know, I believe oil is abiotic, abiogenic. It comes out of the earth. But then the question becomes, you know, these issues of peak oil, and maybe we're extracting more than it's renewing. How do you sort of see energy and resources as a whole? Do you think they are finite to an extent, or we just have an abundance of energy?
I don't exactly know. You know, I do know that when I went to school in the former Yugoslavia in the 1970s, that they told us that oil would run out in 30 years. And that was more than 30 years ago. So, you know, no sign of shortage there. But even if the resources was finite, I think that without overly panicked intervention by our globalist governments, what would happen is that, you know, if there were shortages in the supply of oil, then its price would gradually go up over time. And as it got more expensive, people would adjust. You know, maybe instead of everybody driving their own car to work, people would carpool. Maybe there would be infrastructure investment into public transportation so that we get something like, you know, like in Switzerland or in Japan, where, you know, you can practically get from anywhere to anywhere very efficiently and very comfortable through public transportation. People will maybe go back, instead of living in sprawling suburban neighborhoods, maybe they would go back to something resembling more Mediterranean villages, where you have houses built close together because they're much more energy efficient that way. Maybe families would go back to living, you know, in multi-generational arrangements, because, you know, it's easier to maintain one large household than to maintain many small households, and so forth. And then, you know, with today's technology, the computer-aided design and all the scientific and technical know-how and talent that we have accessible now through the internet, maybe old technologies like steam engine could be revamped and made much, much more efficient and much more convenient to use. You know, in the 1920s, they had phenomenal steam-powered cars. That was in 1920s. I mean, 100 years later, maybe we could have way, way, way better steam-powered cars, and maybe you could then, like in the Back to the Future, put in some banana peels and crap in it, and it would run perfectly well. Who knows? You know, if it were left to free markets, I'm sure that we would transition with only maybe minor disruptions, and the humanity would adjust. As it is, you know, we have these inbred degenerates plotting the course for us and deciding that, oh no, these big giant windmills are going to save us, or the solar panels are going to save us, and then, you know, trillions upon trillions of you know, social wealth, of society's wealth, is being dumped into these money holes that end up, you know, bringing nothing sustainable, in fact, and they only create even more problems. So I think in and of itself, the energy crisis could be, we could transition through it relatively easily with minor disruptions. But the problem is these very highly ideologized agendas that are being forced down everybody's throat, even though they make no sense whatsoever. But now, you know, everybody's so committed that they can't let it go, and they can't even allow a different kind of thinking. And in fact, just us talking about this now is probably makes us thought criminals.
Yes, I'm currently on two strikes on YouTube, and I would agree with your assessment. I think we can adapt. I recently had on the show Calvin Beisner of Cornwall Alliance. They published a fantastic book, Climate and Energy. If people go to cornwallalliance.org, and even if they donate like $5, they'll and you ask them, they'll send you the book for free. At war, right? And so, the big topic here, maybe what you mentioned earlier, it seems like this seems to be, I think, the biggest issue or topic that maybe overshadows everything else that we're talking about. In the last many months, I've been commenting on my various programs, the trend, just extrapolating. Croatia is talking about our home country of Croatia is talking about conscription, Serbia, the Baltic countries, maybe Germany, so many countries. And it, for me, and you know, the West, just yesterday, absolute insanity. There was this report that NATO, Stavridis, right? He came out and said, NATO military alliance should consider broadening its membership to include Asia-Pacific nations like Australia, Japan, New Zealand, South Korea, Philippines, Thailand, and Singapore. And my comment there is NATO seeks to become the totalitarian one world army for the totalitarian one world government. Absolute insanity. And, you know, one of our favorite intellectuals, I think you'd agree, Admiral Davor Domazet Lošo. I've got one of his books here. I know you've talked about him. I have Strategia Vucek Chopora, his book right up there behind me. And he's been doing some podcasts. And I saw him a week ago give an interview where he was basically positing that it seems like he was talking about this conscription trend. And it seems like the West wants to take Europe and throw it at Russia for another war. Yes. And so what are your thoughts regarding, I mean, these insane statements to, they want basically NATO to become the one world army. If you're talking about bringing in Thailand and Philippines, and they're already in Colombia, I found an article from 2 years ago that says, floating the idea of having Mexico join NATO. So it's clear the plan from the beginning is to you have the one world government, UN, and you have the one world military, NATO. Your thoughts on where we are geopolitically?
Yes, I actually think that this is the most important subject everybody should be laser focused on, because, you know, what we saw over the last 10 years in Ukraine is the very same agenda that is now being thrown against all the other countries in the West, but particularly countries like Germany and France and Poland and the Baltic states, Romania, Moldova, and so forth. Namely, you know, Ukraine is now currently being absolutely destroyed. They lost up to 500,000 young men in this completely senseless war that they were never going to win. And their country is being absolutely devastated. If we go back to 2014 and the coup that happened just about 10 years ago, it was a Western orchestrated coup, probably CIA and MI6 doing the works and other Western intelligence agencies. Ukrainians didn't want a fight with Russia. Ukrainians didn't feel any hostility towards Russia and the Russian people. They're so intertwined. They share the same heritage, the same culture, and they have so much overlapping, even family ties, that, you know, going to war against Russia was not on anybody's mind for any reason. But somehow 10 years, and not only that, but, you know, if you remember in 2014, during the first elections in Ukraine, the two extreme right neo-Nazi parties, the Svoboda and the right sector, together got 1.6% of the vote. So they were extremely unpopular. They had no support. And then even in 2019, Zelensky was swept into power with 73% of the vote because he was promising peace with Eastern Ukraine, because he was promising normalization of relations with Russia, because he was promising re-legalization of the Russian language. That's why people put him where he is today. And then 2 years later, Ukraine is in this big war and the country is destroyed. And even in February 2022, so we're talking about literally days before the beginning of the special military operation, the Kiev International Institute for Sociology ran a poll in Ukraine asking people, would you be willing to defend your country with arms, with weapons? And how many Ukrainians answered yes? 11%. Okay. So, sorry, Overall, Ukraine 16%, East Ukraine 5%, South Ukraine 11%. So a very low percentage of Ukrainians wanted that war, even at the outset of the special military operation. And yet somehow the country ends up devastating and loses up to 500,000 young men. And so now this same process of militarization and Nazification starts to become replicated in Western Europe, where more and more politicians are talking about going to war against Russia, when more and more politicians are talking about conscription, when more and more capital is being poured into the defense sector. You know, Germany recently enacted this debt brake, you know, where, you know, the government could only go into debt a certain limited percentage of the GDP. Well, you know, just this week, the defense minister goes on TV and he says like, yes, but, you know, we should make an exception for the defense sector, because all of these digital libraries and bike lanes are not going to do us any good if we're under attack by the Russians. And so, you know, their biggest contractor, Rheinmetall, is now on this massive buying spree. They're building out new production capacities. They're buying up other defense contractors because they want to create the world's largest ammunition producer in the heart of Germany. Why? Because Russia. And so this is how it started in Ukraine, you know. And then you start having these brown shirt movements, which just start with a couple of hundred ridiculous men with nothing better to do, who go parade with placards and dicky torches. But then this movement grows, you know, because somebody's funding it. Somebody's making this happen. You know, you destroy the economy, you create youth unemployment, you have men who have no future, no job prospects, no ways to fulfill their aspirations, get married, raise families, and so forth. And you're saying, hey, why don't you join the brown shirts? You're going to have status, you're going to get some money, and you're going to defend the homeland against evil invaders who are the Russians, you know. And so the ranks swell, and they become more confident, and they become more boisterous, and they become more visible and louder, and then they become, you know, like the Azov battalion, like the Aydar battalion, like the right sector in Ukraine, and they start to terrorize the rest of the population, and they start to scoop up young men and old men now and boys off the streets of Kiev for a couple of $100 a piece, you know, incentivized, and shoving them onto the Eastern Front into the meat grinder. And so, you know, the same way this happened to the Ukrainians could happen to us. And if we just like shrug our shoulders and think like, wow, this is crazy, where is this going? Years down the road, it might be our children under the flags of Croatia lying in the ground, or flags of Germany or Poland or France or whoever. Because this is a process. This is like a social engineering process that is slowly pushing us into a big war against Russia again. And we shouldn't be complacent, because it's happened before and it's been devastating, and it's being done again. And so for anybody who doesn't want to see their children buried under the flag of their country for the glory of the homeland, better pitch a fit right about now and push back.
I think you explained it very well. I'm rewatching again. I never got to finish The Man in the High Castle from Amazon. Philip Dick's, based on Philip Dick's science fiction. You know, he did Blade Runner, and he posited, he created this alternative history where the West loses World War II and the Japanese Empire and the Nazi Germany take over the world, take over the U.S. And you see the same dynamics that you're discussing. We can see a building again where Europe comes together, becomes totalitarian, and then starts another global war. And I could just see that trend. It's like Brussels is sucking in all of the other countries into this defense buildup, into this technocratic totalitarian system, launching insane wars. And so do you have any thoughts on, just quick, on any of the other fronts perhaps of, you know, I think you may have mentioned this before, and I have this view that a lot of the things that are happening around the world are connected to these tectonic shifts, you know, Israel, Gaza, Iran, you spent some time in Venezuela, and you see Venezuela now talking about annexing its neighbor Guyana, and we have U.S. Mexico. Is that just quick thoughts on some of these developments? Is this what happens when Pax Americana declines, and then other powers say, "Hey, no one's going to do anything. Let's go take this territory," or Azerbaijan and Nagorno-Karabakh and Armenia? Just quick thoughts on some of these other flashpoints.
Well, yeah, there are many flashpoints that could be triggered. Because the Western establishment today is clearly on the losing side of history, and I think that they are sufficiently desperate that they might try to launch arson attack about everywhere they can think of. They're running terror operations in the Balochistan, in Pakistan, they're funding the MEK against Iran. They're trying to pitch Greece against Turkey, Armenia, Azerbaijan. Yeah, many, many, many of these flashpoints. I think that at the same time, the Russia, China, Iran side are very well aware of the many traps and many pitfalls that are being set up for them. And so far, I can see that they're not falling for it. Last example was Israel's attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus. So that was clearly an act of war. This was clearly something for which Iran could legitimately retaliate. But they haven't done so. And it's been how many days now? I think it's been 10 or 11 days. So the attack happened on the 1st of April. We are 11th April now. So far, Iran has done nothing. I think that Iran perfectly understand that this was a provocation, that if they retaliated against Israel, that the United States would almost certainly join Israel, and they would launch a military, at the very least, airstrikes against Iran, that they would probably target Iranian nuclear facilities. And who knows, possibly the Israelis are desperate enough that they might even attack Iran with nuclear weapons. So they didn't respond. They will respond, but how and when, we don't know. It's going to be something asymmetric. So it's, all these crisis flashpoints that they count on to destabilize nations and regions around the world are not responding in the way that they, that they might have done, who knows, 20, 30 years ago. And so all their arsonist attempts are meeting capable, fire brigades. And I'm pretty convinced that the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians are cooperating very closely and coordinating their responses. And then Iranians, today, they cooperate closely with Saudi Arabia, and they have cooperation with Oman and other countries in the region. And they are aware of how the battle is won. And the battle is won by slowly grinding the West out of the region and not giving them a trigger for World War III. So, so far so good. Let's hope that it continues this way. And let us hope that this march to war is going to wear out. And that, obviously Western populations are already pretty fatigued with this whole thing. They're not inspired. They're not, this whole beating the war drums against Russia because, all our problems are because Vladimir Putin, and, all of the problems of the North Americas is because China and the CCP, right? It's starting to get old, and people are not really responding. So we have to continue talking about it. We have to continue disbelieving the narrative and simply not cooperating with the program.
Yeah, I'd agree again with your assessment. And, you know, one of the other, for me, you know, maybe listeners have other questions or viewpoints, but I try to hit at what I think are the big issues and questions of our time for me. And I think another one is as well, USA, what happens in the American empire. We got the elections, this talk of second civil war, seemingly tyranny rising, right? And it's linked, you know, Brazil, you know, they're having this spat, the Supreme Court judge there, which is absolutely insane. I mean, you just look at this guy. It's just, Moraes, I think, Alejandro Moraes, his face is just oozes evil. He could be like Darth Vader, and they're just shutting down free speech in Brazil. And I think they're probably, you know, in line with the Biden regime. What do you see for America on the home front and everything that's happening here?
Well, here's what I think about the United States. I think that the United States is probably the central battle for the future of humanity. And in a way, this is encouraging to me because the United States, maybe more than any other major power in the world, has certain healthy foundations in their democratic institutions. So they have the state rights. They have a lot of local politics that actually end up shaping the national politics. Their county sheriffs get locally elected, so they're accountable to their local communities. And I see that the American people are increasingly waking up and are understanding the predicament that they're in, and that they have to take an active role in shaping the events that are going on. And you know, it's as George Soros quite correctly put it, we are in a conflict between two systems of governance. And so the United States is ultimately being given the choice of whether they want to be the enforcement arm of the Western Empire, if they want to be the global policeman and maintain military bases all around the world at their expense and keep being permanently at war everywhere, or if they want to build a future that, you know, gives them prosperity, that gives them an enjoyable life, that gives a good future to their children and so forth. And then maybe, you know, joining these multipolar integrations so that they can trade with other nations around the world on a fair basis, because the United States has a lot to give to the world. You know, they have a healthy economy, manufacturing, you know, there's a lot that United States could trade with the rest of the world rather than just being the policeman of the world. And I think that more and more people are waking up to that choice, and they're going to, you know, I think that every day more and more people are weighing in on that side versus the empire side, which is, I think, why the ruling establishment is in a tizzy, because they think that this is all Russian propaganda and that, you know, we have to clamp down on misinformation and disinformation. They just don't want people to continue to wake up and make their own decisions about how things stand. So I think that for the global empire, for the globalists, the position of the United States is absolutely essential, because without the United States on their side, which it currently is under the Biden administration, their whole thing collapses like a house of cards. What's going to be left? You know, Britain, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. You know, that's not a big, you know, that's not even contiguous, but it's not, none of them are powers in any sense of the world, in any sense of the word. And with the United States, they are a power. And so what they perceive, and you can see that in various articles published by the Chatham House in London, is that they're absolutely panicked at the prospect of Donald Trump coming back to the White House, because then that choice between reverting to the Republican roots or remaining an empire enforcement arm, is going to be solidified. And so this, I think, is the crux of the battle now. And even if you absolutely hate Donald Trump, it is throwing a massive spanner into their works. And so I think that the next election might get things to a very, very interesting next play.
Well, we'll find out soon. Is there any other issue or topic that's sort of on your mind that you think is important that I haven't brought up?
Yes. And I mentioned this in the call we had the other day at the Medical Doctors for COVID Ethics, and this is just like a thought that occurred to me when I was watching the BBC documentary where they were filming a group of Bushmen hunting a giraffe, right? So they injure a giraffe, but then they have to run after it for quite a while. I think it's maybe like a few days, until the giraffe finally collapses from exhaustion. And then at the end of the first day, they set up camp and then they sit around the fire and they shoot shit and socialize, you know? And they talk about this and that. And the guy who was making the documentary, he's like, but yeah, but what about the giraffe? And the Bushman respond that, oh, no, we do not talk about the giraffe. And he says, why? And they said, because if we talk about the giraffe, it's making the giraffe stronger. And so, I don't know, maybe this is some ancient native wisdom that's legitimate. But the reason why it made me ponder is because, you know, we are beset by 1,000 battles on all fronts, you know, the wokery, the Black Lives Matter, the inflation, the economic crisis, the LGBT stuff and everything altogether, left versus right, Democrats versus Republicans. It's everybody's going hysterical over 1,000 things. And we discover that this is being done to us by some invisible enemy, and we find ourselves mesmerized and transfixed. And people spend so much time discussing all this. And at some point, I think, like, so it's very important for us to understand what we're up against. But at the same time, I think we also should divert our focus to the world that we want to build in the future. Because by focusing too much on this, on the enemy, maybe we're making the enemy stronger. You know, maybe once you understood the enemy, the right thing to do is to ignore it and to move on and to think about the world we want to live for our children and their children and everything that we can do to make those changes that are necessary for that good transition to take place, rather than being completely immersed in the darkness. Because even Nietzsche said that when you stare into the abyss, you have to be aware that the abyss is staring back into you. So that, you know, I think that's kind of the thought that came to me. And I thought, we really need to talk more about the world of tomorrow that we want. And then another thing that I kind of find a little bit vexing about the way these things are being discussed, that many people, you know, not with any bad intentions, but they talk about these things like the CBDCs and the control matrix and all of these things, like it's going to be. They're going to bring the CDC and we're going to have to do this and they're going to do this to us. How about saying this is what they want to achieve, but never in a freaking million years are they going to succeed because we're not going to let them. So, you know, like it's one thing to formulate the thought of like saying, oh, yeah, this is what they've planned. This is what they want to achieve. It's a different thing to make an affirmative statement. This is how it's going to be. Well, it's going to be that way if you let it happen that way. But if you resist, if you seed the whole system with like 1,000 points of friction, with 100 million points of friction, there's just no way it's going to happen that way. So let's stop affirming their agenda and let's start affirming our agenda.
I think that's excellent advice, and I'm seeing already some alternative and independent media saying exactly what you are. I was in January, I was at the Greater Reset Conference, and Derek Rose, one of the organizers, I was doing my TNT show, and I asked him to just say hello, and he said, stop talking about Klaus Schwab and start thinking of solutions, parallel structures, decentralization, Amen. All this sort of stuff. And so I think, and in many ways, as you say, we're doing, you know, maybe Cobra Commander Klaus will seed these ideas of this dystopia, and then we're carrying it forward. We're doing the work for him. And as you say, the system is precarious that they want to install. And so we just have to, there's many places where we can put spokes in their wheel, as has been done throughout all of history with these totalitarian empires and regimes.
Yes, exactly. This is not the first generation of oligarchs who have these megalomaniacal ideas about ruling the world and having everybody under control. This is like a 3,000-year-old story. They always fail. Why should they succeed this time?
And this is actually one of the reasons I recently left TNT Radio. I might come on again if it's part-time, but just multiple hours every day, me having to talk about this stuff, I felt also wasn't healthy for me. And, you know, right. This is why I want more time now. I'm reading books, watching TV shows, because for your own sanity, because every day talking about the globalist stuff, it's not healthy. And I thought I'd share this as well. I posted it on my socials. Todd Friel, a Christian speaker, he recently said something very interesting. He said, you and I are not built to receive all of the information that you and I get through our daily dose of browsing through our feeds, checking out all the news sites. Is it possible that you and I are experiencing something we were not intended to experience? Could it be that God didn't wire us to carry every event taking place in every part of the world at every moment as if it were ours? And I think to that point, we have to focus more locally. Like we were on that call the other day where I was a guest and people were floating questions and ideas, and someone said, what are we going to do? We're not doing enough. And my thing is like, we can't do everything. You know, I'm here in Mexico. I'm doing what I can in Mexico. You do what you can wherever you are. You know, we can't be Superman, you know? And so, do you have any advice, maybe perhaps key principles for people on how to prepare for the political, economic shocks that may be coming, or, you know, mentally, you know, health-wise, just going forward?
Well, I think it's, first of all, you know, like I'm an incurable optimist. So, you know, I'm pretty certain down in my heart of hearts that we're going to be fine. That even if we go through a bumpy ride, we're going to be fine. And that if we even make a moderate effort, we really have a chance to build them, not a better world for tomorrow, but the kind of world that perhaps at this time would defy most of our imaginations. Because we're only going, you know, we were born and raised within this matrix for generations now. You know, imagine chickens who are bred inside of the chicken coop for generations. They have no concept of the outside world. Not only that, they have no concept of themselves existing in that outside world. So I think that we have wonderful discoveries to look forward to, not only about living with full lungs in freedom and prosperity and liberty, but also discovering that we are quite something divine versus, you know, the hackable animals that they want to make us into and which they are persuading us that we are. You know, since Thomas Hobbes characterizing humanity as, you know, like if we didn't have these overlords, our life would be nasty, brutish, and short. Oh, really? You know, and then you read, you know, like if you read the journals of of all these world travelers from past centuries who visit native tribes throughout Africa and Australasia and everywhere. And they always report that, like, oh my God, what I encountered there was like the Garden of Eden, and everybody's happy and everybody's healthy. And even today, you can find, I think Joe Rogan had a guy recently who went to some tribe, I forget where, and he said, oh my God, these people are all supermodels. That's what they look like. You know, they're super fit and healthy and beautiful looking. And all they do all day is shoot shit and laugh and have fun and enjoy life, you know? So, you know, I think that we will learn a lot about ourselves, and we're going to like a lot about what we learn.
Yeah.
And I would leave your listeners and viewers, if I can convey that faith to them, that we're all going to be fine. Just literally believe in that and stay focused on what you want in life and what you want for your children's lives. And we're going to make it happen, because we're, you know, the guest the other day was clearly frustrated a little bit with a sense where we're at. But, you know, there's not millions of us. There's hundreds of millions of us who are human beings, which means that we all share certain core human values. And we can't be turned into hackable animals, and we can't be herded into these 15-minute cities against our will. So, you know, everybody's pitching in. Everybody's awakening at their time and in their moment. And I think the wonderful things are ahead of us. We just have to keep... The only way we can fail is either if we surrender, which we're not gonna, or if we fall for this, you know, militarization, Nazification, misdirection, and they corral us into another traumatizing world war. But let's not let that happen either.
I love how you always say upward and onward. And you recall past guests of mine, in some ways he's almost like a mentor, Bob Moriarty. Maybe he's listening now. He also supports the podcast, 321gold.com, Vietnam vet, 800 sorties. And he said, last time I chatted with him, we're going to make it. We always do. You know, and so I respect a lot of my elders, the people I have on the program, like yourself, and their wisdom. And just what, you know, just to add to what you said, I just had the feeling that we should proudly espouse these human values against their anti-human values. Like, no, like I met someone not long ago who's into biohacking and transhumanism at one of these alt media conferences. And, you know, we should be like, no, I'm not going to biohack. No, it's not normal. No, you know, with you know, people who are starting to internalize and think these things are normal, friends and family and acquaintances around us, like, no, I'm proudly a no-vaxxer. I'm not going to be injected. You know, we should espouse proudly these ideals of freedom, and make, you know, that's sort of where we draw the line and stop with that sort of stuff. And so, always great chatting, Alex. Let us know again your projects, best books, websites, services, and so forth.
So I'm easy to find on X. My handle is at Naked Hedgy. I write a Substack called Alex Craner's Trend Compass. And for investors and traders, I publish by subscription a daily newsletter called The Trend Compass, covering up to 200 financial and commodities markets.
All right, the links are in the description. And, you know, maybe I see you one of these days back home in Hrvatska. You know, it'd be the ultimate if you and I sat down with Davor Domazet Lošo for an interview. That would be
brilliant. Yes, that would be great. Let's make that happen. Let's make that happen, Hrvoje.
I hope you enjoyed this Geopolitics and Empire podcast. The website is geopoliticsandempire.com, and I encourage you to sign up for the free email list that goes out with each podcast and every weekend with a collection of news headlines. The newsletter and website are our last lines of defense. We're being censored and deplatformed. It's nearly impossible to find Geopolitics and Empire on the Google search engine. We've been blacklisted. YouTube frequently takes down our videos with strikes. Facebook restricts our page. Reddit and Twitter take down posts. And after the Associated Press mentioned geopolitics and empire in a 2021 article co-written with NATO, our Patreon account was terminated. Vimeo also terminated our pro account. The best free way to help geopolitics and empire is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere and subscribe to all of our media channels. You can find the video broadcast now on 5 platforms: Odyssey, Rockfin, Rumble, BitChute, and Brighteon. You can find the audio broadcast on the podcast ecosystem: SoundCloud, Apple, Spotify, and so on. My current favorite social media channels are Twitter and Telegram, but you can also find us on Gab, MeWe, Minds, Float, VK, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Finally, Geopolitics and Empire is in dire need of funding to continue. You can leave a donation, purchase a consultation with the host, or become a member to receive additional benefits. We also produce a weekly broadcast called Dissident Thinker for members and Rockfin subscribers only. We will continue to fight the good fight, come hell or high water. Thank you for listening.